Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We are recording this at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 26th of April. The Sudanese army says the country's ousted ruler, Omar al-Bashir, is still in custody, despite the escape of another alleged war criminal during the fighting. US officials claim that the Taliban have killed the IS leader behind the Kabul airport bombing. And a Taiwanese man who disappeared while visiting China turns up in detention. Also in the podcast, drought forces the Panama Canal authorities to impose a limit on shipping. And
the only things I'm keeping are the personal gifts that he gave me. I decided that if I was going to sell, I had to be brave and sell the lot.
The huge sale of personal items that once belonged to Queen frontman Freddie Mercury. Despite a reduction in violence during the three-day ceasefire in Sudan, there have been some clashes in and around Khartoum. The RSF paramilitary group is reported to have seized an oil refinery 70 kilometres north of the capital. They're also accused of attacking a jail and freeing high-profile figures from the detested former regime of Omar al-Bashir. The army later confirmed that the ousted former president is still in custody in a military hospital after being moved from the prison before the fighting broke out. But his key aide, Ahmed Haroon, who is also wanted for war crimes, did escape. Majak Diagot, former Sudanese intelligence official, told my colleague James Copnell more about him.
Ahmed Haroon was the deputy interior minister. He was fully involved in directing the campaign in Darfur. That led to his indictment by the International Criminal Court. So with his escape from prison with a number of other NCP leaders who were involved in pursuing the war of extermination in a number of regions in the Sudan, I think this is going to get really bad.
But why? Why would this potentially change the dynamics of the conflict?
They have been the invisible auctioneer in this whole process. They have been involved in trying to fan up the crisis to this level, although they have been trying to be careful to expose themselves as the main manipulators of this crisis. But now that they are out, would we see a situation where there are three parties to the conflict, or is the Islamists going to associate themselves with one of the parties in the conflict? This is what we'll see.
Former Sudanese intelligence and security official Majak Diagot talking to James Copnell. The slight pause in the fighting since the weekend has allowed several thousand foreigners to leave Sudan. Political commentator Dalia Abdelmonem fled Khartoum with her family.
People are trying to escape to save their own lives. So if you can afford it and if you have the cash in hand and if you have the means, you can find a way out. For many others, they will take whatever they can find. I mean, I saw people on open back trucks, which are used to transport merchandise and goods. No safety, and they're all like a pack of sardines, people just trying to escape. For 2 days, we were trying to find a coach to take us from Khartoum to Port Sudan, which is on the eastern coast. I think we called maybe 50 companies and so many different drivers, and there were so many excuses. There's no diesel, or we had to meet the bus in a certain area of Khartoum, which we couldn't get to. By pure luck, a relative told us about there being a bus available with 7 spaces. So we quickly decided, okay, we're going to split the group up. We were 23 people, that the vulnerable, i.e. the elderly and mothers with young kids, would be the first to leave. But when we ended up going to the place where the buses were departing from, I was very happy to see that we all actually ended up being on the same bus. So we got to Port Sudan.
Dalia Abdelmonem. Well, our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams is monitoring the situation in Sudan from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. He told me first more about that jailbreak involving Ali Haroon and what it could mean for the current conflict.
Well, as you heard from that former Sudanese official, it could have meaning. I mean, these are people who were all implicated in the violence that tore through the country, in particular in the Darfur region in the early 2000s. So these are people who are very much implicated in what the international community regards as war crimes and genocide. When it comes to Omar al-Bashir himself, there has been some uncertainty about his whereabouts. But this morning, the Al Jazeera network cited sources in his family as saying that the former president is still in hospital, in a military hospital where he's receiving treatment. He's quite elderly, as are some of his former associates. So it seems as though Omar al-Bashir may not be a player right now, or at least not on the loose. But I think there is the fear that as some of his former colleagues escape from prison, they could become part of the sort of political crisis that is raging in Sudan right now. They could be on one side or the other. They could play a role, and that role, as you heard from that former official, might not be to the country's benefit.
Yeah, and this ceasefire, we're now halfway through. What is likely to happen when it expires?
Very good question, and frankly, no one knows. I presume, though we do not have privy to this, that there will be frantic efforts behind the scenes involving a number of different players to try and extend that ceasefire. It was brokered by the United States and Saudi Arabia. I'm sure they're trying to extend it and maybe to broaden it and to turn it into something a bit more like some kind of a political process. Because don't forget, just before this violence erupted, the country should have been moving gradually towards some kind of democratic transition. Now, that's been the case for the last 4 years, and it hasn't happened, largely through the efforts of the two men leading, you know, the current military factions. But that is still the trajectory which many, many people in Sudan want the country to be on, and presumably the international community would like to see that happen. But that feels like a very remote prospect. I think all that people are focused on right now is getting their own civilians out, and, you know, with another day and a half to go, I presume that that airstrip just to the north of the capital will be intensively in use, and there will be other convoys, such as the one you heard described just now, heading for Port Sudan and elsewhere. But the UN is very, very worried about what happens when the international community is gone, the ceasefire is over. What then happens to Sudan? They are sounding some pretty severe alarm bells, talking about the possibility of 250,000 people possibly being on the move.
Paul Adams with the latest on events in Sudan. US officials say Taliban fighters in Afghanistan recently killed an Islamic State militant suspected of being behind the devastating bombing of Kabul airport during the withdrawal of US-led forces in 2021. At least 170 Afghans and 13 US soldiers were killed in the attack, which came as thousands of people desperately queued to get onto evacuation flights. American officials told CBS that the IS leader died weeks ago, but it took time to confirm his death. His name has not been released. Jack Detch, national security reporter at Foreign Policy magazine, spoke to Reddy Klabi.
A lot of the details are still murky here. This person was likely killed a couple of weeks ago in this Taliban raid. DOD officials still refusing to directly identify exactly who this person is. But it seems to indicate here that the U.S. has a bit of intelligence capability left over Afghanistan as it flies these drone sorties looking into the country. That's significant because they didn't get this intelligence specifically from the Taliban. They got it themselves. It's not clear what it's going to mean in terms of the counterterrorism picture. The U.S. claimed as they left Afghanistan after this horrible bombing that they would be able to conduct strikes from over the horizon, basically flying drones in from the Gulf and taking the fight to ISIS Khorasan. We've only seen one strike so far, that killing, of course, the al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. So it's not clear that the U.S. is going to be able to maintain that drumbeat of strikes. And this again shows that the infighting on the ground is dictating the picture, not American military capability.
Just speaking of that, I mean, since the Taliban retook power, the U.S. has been reluctant to work closely with them. But this killing suggests perhaps that they are more reliant on the Taliban in combating terrorism than they would like to admit.
It's policy by proxy to a degree, but there's no direct relationship, of course. The U.S. has only met diplomatically with the Taliban once since the killing of Ayman al-Zawahiri by that drone strike last year. So there's no strong diplomatic relationship. Of course, there's been a freeze out with the sanctions and with the aid that's meant to go to Afghanistan being split between a Geneva bank and the families of 9/11 victims. So you have this ongoing diplomatic freeze, no sign of a thaw. What you do see, of course, is, again, this intensifying tit for tat between ISIS-K and the Taliban that dates back all the way to Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar, but has been going on at a much more significant clip in the past 6 months, basically a tit for tat as they've been having gunfights near the city of Jalalabad, Afghanistan's fifth largest city. And this is just another sign that basically they're going to take that fighting up another notch and go after signature leaders here. So the U.S., again, without a lot of influence, without a lot of cards to play, but it seems like these tensions are just going from bad to worse between ISIS and the Taliban.
Foreign Policy Magazine reporter Jack Detch. The Chinese Communist Party doesn't tolerate criticism. When it started to crack down on the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong in 2015, five booksellers disappeared and turned up in custody on the Chinese mainland. Now it's been revealed that a prominent Taiwanese publisher who vanished on a recent visit to China is in detention there, being investigated under China's draconian national security law. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told us more about him.
His name is Li Yanhe, and he's really an important figure for anybody in the Chinese-speaking world who wants an objective view of what's going on inside China. That's because he was the editor-in-chief of Gusa Publishing. Gusa Publishing is located in the self-ruled island of Taiwan, and it was really one of the few remaining publishing houses that published books that were critical of the Communist Party or had a good look at China's detention of around 1 million Muslim Uyghurs, or what happened back in 1989 when Beijing shut down pro-democracy protests there. So the fact that he has disappeared, he's now been identified as being under investigation under national security laws, is really concerning because it possibly highlights a new attempt by the Chinese government to shut down this really key publishing house.
Yeah, and he was just on a visit to mainland China from Taiwan, a self-governing island. What does it mean for anyone else wanting to publish information in the Chinese language?
Yeah, I mean, that's really it. He was there to visit some relatives, and now he's being prosecuted under national security law. So we're frankly probably not going to learn much more. It's almost inevitable that he's going to be facing a closed door trial. This is really key because if a publishing house like Gusa Publishing is shut down, it means that people in China, the Chinese speaking world, there are going to be clear limits on what information is available to them. Gusa Publishing also published books from other languages into Chinese. They're one of the few high-profile publishing houses that did that, that weren't really subjected to mainland China's censorship laws. So really, it's freedom of speech that's at risk today, not just the fate, an unfortunate fate, of one man, Li Yanhe.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. Handwritten lyrics, extravagant costumes and instruments are among 1,500 personal items that once belonged to singer-songwriter Freddie Mercury, now being sold at auction. The Queen frontman built up the collection, which includes works of art, over three decades. It is expected to sell for around $7.5 million. Freddie Mercury left it all to his former girlfriend, Mary Austin, who has been talking to our arts correspondent, Rebecca Jones.
Freddie Mercury leading the crowd at Live Aid in 1985. In public, he was the ultimate showman. In private, Freddie Mercury retreated to a home he filled with art and objects that reflected his taste and inspired his imagination. His close friend, Mary Austin, was a frequent visitor.
I don't have that many people to turn to. The only one is Mary. She's been a girlfriend of mine for a long time, and she's about the only person I can think about.
A day after revealing to the world that he had AIDS, the rock star Freddie Mercury has died. As lead singer of the group Queen...
When Freddie Mercury died in 1991, he left that home and its contents to Mary Austin. She's lived in the house, surrounded by Freddie Mercury's furniture, paintings, instruments and costumes for three decades. But now Mary Austin is selling up.
I decided to sell because I need to put my affairs in order.
How did you decide? I mean, I'm assuming there are some things you're keeping. How did... Nothing?
No. The only things I'm keeping are the personal gifts that he gave me. I decided that it wouldn't be appropriate for me to keep things back. If I was going to sell, I had to be brave and sell the lot.
So there's the acoustic guitar on which it's thought he wrote and recorded Crazy Little Thing Called Love. There are costumes including his famous fake fur and red velvet crown trimmed with rhinestones and matching cloak, along with artworks by Picasso and Matisse and a small, solid silver moustache comb. Those were the days of our lives. The sale at Sotheby's is expected to raise £6 million, with some of the proceeds going to charity.
Is there anything, though, that's been particularly difficult to part with?
His written lyrics. She keeps in a pretty cabinet. You're looking at the process of the artist, the crossings out, the rethinking, the reformatting. It's just a reflection of Freddie.
There are lyrics written in black biro for Killer Queen. Caviar and cigarettes, well versed in etiquette, extraordinarily nice. She's a killer. Lyrics to We Are the Champions are written across 9 pages and include harmonies and chords.
If he'd written something, did he used to play it to you?
No. No, that was his personal private journey. For the amount of time he spent working on Bohemian Rhapsody, I didn't hear any of it until it was a finished, completed work from the studio.
Do you miss him?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I miss the fun, the humour. Yeah, his warmth, his energy. Huge.
Freddie Mercury's friend Mary Austin, ending that report by Rebecca Jones. Still to come.
When you have a population of over 45% of workers that want to quit today, it's time for employers to stand up and listen.
What to do about quiet quitting? At dawn today in the city-state of Singapore, a 46-year-old man called Tangaraju Supia was hanged in Changi Prison. He'd been convicted of conspiracy to smuggle 1 kilogram of cannabis, though rights groups have strongly criticised the investigation. Anti-death penalty campaigner Kokila Annamalai said the case was deeply flawed.
He did not have a lawyer present during police interrogations, and the statements that were taken from him were in a language that he said he did not fully understand, were taken in English, and he was denied the interpreter. He also said in court that he had to bring a review application to reopen his case by himself.
Singapore has some of the toughest drug laws in the world and insists the death penalty remains an effective deterrent. Katie Silver in Singapore told me more about the case.
This came about after, in 2018, he was convicted for his role in drug trafficking. It involved an operation that occurred back in 2013, about just over a kilo of cannabis brought in from neighbouring Malaysia into Singapore. It all centred around 2 mobile phones, which the court found he had used to text and to coordinate this operation. He said that one of these weren't his and that the other had been lost. There were lots of questions as well about whether or not he received appropriate legal representation. as well as an interpreter. He spoke Tamil, and his family said that his English wasn't very strong and that there were certain times, including in his dealings with police, where he wasn't given appropriate interpretation. Singapore, for its part, said that due process occurred, but there were multiple pleas for clemency, and they went up as far as the president. And it was indeed hugely criticised, you know, from both his family, activists. The United Nations, for its part, said that the death penalty should only be reserved for the most serious of cases and that drug offences do not count for that. And in fact, the UN had called on Singapore to halt this execution. So it's certainly been criticised by many different quarters.
Yeah, and yet, despite those criticisms, the sentence went ahead, a sign of the harsh justice system in Singapore.
They are among the toughest drug laws in the world, but they do have widespread support amongst the Singaporean population. And the government defends them, saying that they are important for the safety and security of Singapore and that they act as a deterrent. The problem in part is that it is a mandatory death sentence, so courts don't have the freedom or flexibility in order to look at things on a case-by-case basis.
Now, in many parts of the world, not least states in America, the use of cannabis has been decriminalised. How is it treated across Asia?
Interestingly, same thing has actually happened in Thailand. Last year, we saw Thailand decriminalise cannabis and, in fact, encourage its trade. And just earlier this month, for example, we saw in Malaysia, they abolished the mandatory death penalty for drug trafficking. They said that it doesn't actually act as an effective deterrent. But without a doubt, here in Singapore, there is a strong support for the continuation of this policy, other than amongst the activists, as well as the fact that the government is very supportive of it as well and does not seem to be showing any signs of budging.
Katie Silva in Singapore. The Panama Canal, linking the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific, is one of the busiest shipping routes in the world, accounting for around 6% of maritime trade. But it has a major problem. A severe lack of rain has forced the authorities to limit shipping for the fifth time during this drought season. So how bad is it? Chantal Hartle has been investigating.
Panama has been experiencing, Ollie, actually, severe droughts for quite some time. But this has been described as the most difficult drought conditions that it's seen yet, all linked to the effects of climate change. And each time a ship passes through the locks of the Panama Canal, 200 million litres of fresh water are needed. That's every single time. Every year, 14,000 ships are crossing the waterway, so that gives you an idea of just how much water is being used. Now, one of the two main lakes that feeds water into the canal, Lake Alajuela, has effectively dried up just because of a lack of rainfall. And in the space of a month between March 21st and April 21st, the water level fell by more than 10%. Leiden Guevara lives near the Alajuela Lake.
It has been difficult for the fishermen, for the residents, because those who bought their cargo from the other side of the lake have to carry it on their shoulders. When the water was here, the cars would come and fetch it. So this has been one of the most difficult years.
Well, as with previous droughts, the Canal Authority has temporarily put in restrictions on how much cargo that the larger ships can carry so they can ride higher in the water. But these ships, of course, are paying the highest fees to actually use the waterway. So it's a huge loss for the Panama Treasury, which last year generated $2.5 billion from ships carrying more than 500 million tons of cargo.
Yeah, and it's not just maritime trade. There's also a problem with a lack of drinking water because of this drought.
That's right. The Canal Authority also supplies drinking water to half of Panama's population of 4.3 million people, including the residents of the capital, Panama City. The water comes from the same artificial lakes which are used to run the locks, and the shortage has actually led to numerous protests in recent years about a lack of available drinking water. For years, the authorities have said that they are looking at ways to store more water when it does experience drought, things like deepening the existing lakes, building a new reservoir. But all of these have environmental consequences and none have advanced yet.
Chantal Hartle. It could cost about $10 million. The world's largest rhino farm is up for sale. The Platinum Rhino Project in South Africa is home to 2,000 rhinos and was started by a wealthy conservationist called John Hume. He now says he's penniless and can't afford to run it anymore. More details from Andrew Ochieng.
Tens of baby rhinos suckle from white buckets full of milk at the Platinum Rhino Farm in South Africa. They are part of the 2,000 rhinos, or crush of rhinos, that is up for sale, together with the land that's estimated to be about 8,000 hectares and most of the other facilities. But running what's believed to be the world's largest rhino farm has not been a cheap and easy affair. John Hume was a rich man when he started the project, but says he has spent around $150 million on his massive philanthropic project to save the world's second largest land animal.
I've used all my life savings. I've been expending money on this population of rhinos for 30 years, and I've finally run out of money.
Rhinos are endangered. They have been hunted down almost to extinction for their horns. South Africa today has about 80% of the world's population, with a big number on this farm. Aside from food for the animals, potential buyers will be keen on how to protect them from poachers.
It worries me that, unfortunately, on the black market, a rhino horn from a dead rhino is still worth more than a live rhino.
Hume has previously been a proponent for the legalization of the trade in rhino horns, saying a legal market would drive down their price and help put money into conservation. But critics, especially in other countries with low rhino populations, have opposed this. They argue legalization of the trade will lead to poaching, as it will be impossible to tell where the horns come from. Opening bids for the farm start at $10 million, and the auction will run till the 1st of May.
Andrew Ocheng reporting. Quiet quitting, the practice of doing just the bare minimum at work or leaving the job altogether, appears to be gathering pace. According to a recent study in France, three quarters of people aged 25 to 34 do as little as possible while at work. A third said they wanted to quit altogether. BBC reporter Joshua Thorpe spoke to one woman in her early 30s who's done just that.
I was bored, because I can't be really myself. I can't really express myself, my feelings, my creativity. I felt a little enclosed.
Sabrina Teresi had a high-paying job as an engineer. She'd studied for years to qualify. She enjoyed the job at first, but soon felt demotivated, and after 3 years decided to quit.
I'm a creative person, and for me to do the same things every day with the same people.
So what was it you were looking for in your career? What would have made your career more fulfilled?
Diversity. I like learning. I like discovering. Maybe I had to have more flexible hours. I had to go at the office every day. I work better on my sofa.
And how did you feel after you quit?
I felt released because I knew that was the right choice to change life, to discover what I liked, because I didn't know me. I didn't have dreams at that time.
Well, it's not just an issue in France. A global survey carried out by the consultancy firm McKinsey found that 40% of workers are thinking about leaving their jobs in the next 3 to 6 months. So are we seeing an epidemic of laziness, or do companies need to do much more to retain staff these days? Roger Hearing has been discussing the issue with US recruitment specialist Tammy Browning.
There is a massive difference in the way generations view work. In fact, this age group is really fascinating. This 25 to 34 shows up for a very different reason. It's much more about work and life and balance, which Sabrina was really talking about in some way, shape, or form. There's this priority to do what they love, which is how they were raised. And I think we need to really remember that the generations before them taught these kids to grow up with finding passion for what they love in their work and creating meaningful impact on the world. They also want their employers to support them across several different areas, whether it's their work, their life, their mental health, their well-being. What has been proven is over the first couple of years during pandemic and even beyond pandemic, people were comfortably working from home. They felt good about it. They were embracing their career. They've settled in now. Now, worker productivity is declining at a massive rate of pace. We are seeing it. And so what employers have to do is figure out how to create the way by which people stay engaged in their job, how they stay engaged in their career, because working from home has removed the ability to want to stay connected to your world of work. They don't have connections. They don't have relationships like they used to have. And frankly, they don't have the water cooler, and people and humans thrive on that relationship and building strong careers for the future.
Yes, we'd all like to do what we like doing. We'd all like to do something that's meaningful and important and be valued for it. But I mean, the bottom line is earning money, isn't it?
Yes and no. What we're finding with this generation or in this particular worker type is they want to be able to connect that they work that they do with a meaning and purpose for their outcomes. So as employers, it's incredibly important for us to find reasons for people to show up, to work hard, to give them career mobility, to give them drive, to give them energy. We need to take them outside of their norms, giving them jobs that are maybe over scope for their skill set, giving them things that will give their passion life. And that is where employers could really make a huge impact.
But again, Tammy, people in non-developed countries know that actually what you've got to do is turn up in order to earn the money to feed your children, to have a roof over your head. Isn't this just people in luxury situations having the option of being able to say, oh, no, I don't like that, I'm going home?
No, I wish I could say that it was all about the dollar or the pound or whatever currency you're in. But the fact of the matter is, it is not. People have been able to learn, particularly over the last 3 years, to live with a lot less. And they are comfortable with living with less. They are comfortable with driving their strategies, with understanding what they love to do. Quiet quitting, it's been around for years and years and years. It's just manifested itself in such a different way that it's creating now this organizational awareness because there's such a shortage of talent in the marketplace. So if we really want to change the narrative, stop worrying about what we pay them, because paying them is just table stakes. And when you have a population of over 45% of workers that want to quit today, it's time for employers to stand up and listen and say, help me understand what it is you're looking for your career ambitions. It will be a completely different story in the future.
U.S. recruitment specialist Tammy Browning. That's all from us for now. The Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Lewis Allsop and produced by Nikki Verrico. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.